Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Church of Grace. My name is Patrick Hayes, and today is Friday, January 10th, and we are not back in the book of Matthew yet. We are going over the history of paganism. So I thought this would be a great way to start out the year. Believe it or not, this will be very applicable. So we start in the Roman Empire about 27 to 29 BC in the city of Pergamos. Now, if you are a student of the Bible, you might know where we find the city of Pergamos mentioned. Does anyone know the book in the Bible that mentions Pergamos? Yes, the book of Revelation. In the book of Revelation, Jesus writes seven letters to seven churches, and one of those letters is to the city of Pergamos. In the city of Pergamos, the first temple was erected for the worship of Roman emperors. Emperor worship was also called the imperial cult. So just like the pharaohs in Egypt, the Roman emperors were looked at as and worshipped as gods. After Julius Caesar came Augustus. Augustus was the emperor when Christ was born. After Christ was crucified, resurrected, and ascended into heaven, the Christians faced persecution by the Roman government for a long time. Emperor Nero set fire to Rome and blamed the Christians. He was the one who executed the Apostle Paul. Nero was the beginning of what we call the 10 waves of persecution. In 70 AD, General Titus, under Emperor Vespasian, marched into Jerusalem with four Roman legions. They laid siege to Jerusalem and ultimately destroyed the city and the temple. Jesus said that it would happen in Matthew chapter 24. Now, kids, if you're going to take notes, you write down 70 AD, Titus destroyed Jerusalem. That will be on the test. The Jews have not had a temple since that time. Under Emperor Trajan, Christianity was illegal, punished by banishment. And under Marcus Aurelius, there was one of the most severe persecutions since the time of Nero. If you turned in a Christian, whether they were a neighbor or a friend or a relative, you turned them into the Roman government, you got their land. Think about that. You like the farm next to you? All you got to do is figure out if those folks are Christians. If they are, you turn them into the Roman government, that's your farm. That was a way to root out the Christians. Now, under Marcus Aurelius, the Roman Empire, I believe, this is just my opinion, was probably at its peak. This was the height of the Roman Empire. Now, this fellow Marcus Aurelius, if you have seen the movie The Gladiator with Russell Crowe, okay, the first one, I haven't seen the second one, but the first one, in the beginning of that movie, the old man who's the emperor who ends up dying, that was Marcus Aurelius. But he was not a sweet old man. He was a monster. And he has written several books. He's written philosophy books, and people love to talk about Marcus Aurelius and read his writings. I just want you to know that he was an absolute monster. Emperor Decius required public sacrifice to pagan gods throughout the Roman Empire. This was the famous pinch of incense that was required yearly by every group of people within the Roman Empire. So they actually kept track, and every group of people had to show up, and they had to declare who they were. And there was a fire, and there was a little plate of incense, and they required that you worship the Roman emperor as God. And you did that by offering incense. You took a pinch of incense, and you threw it in the fire. Easy as that. No big deal, right? Just a pinch of incense, and we get to go home. problem is, it is idolatry. And there were two groups that refused to do it. One of those groups had an exemption by the Roman government. The Jews were not required to go and give a pinch of incense to the Roman gods, because the Jews were an old enough and established enough religion, and the Roman Empire recognized through their dealings with the Jews over decades, centuries now, that if we want the Jews to come and worship an idol every year, we will have to kill every man, woman, and child in Judea to get them to comply. And they said, nope, you can have an exemption. The Christians did not have an exemption. And many Christians died because they were not willing to take incense from here and drop it here. What's sad is that so many American Christians, their first thought is, oh, what's the big deal? The big deal is it's idolatry. Do you know what idolatry is compared to in the Bible? What is idolatry compared to in the Bible? Again and again and again. Pam? It is compared to adultery. That's the way God sees it. When we are idolatrous, it is as if we leave our spouse who we love and we just have a quick fling. No big deal. It was only for a minute, and now I'm back. That's the way God sees idolatry. Valerian required the clergy to publicly sacrifice to pagan gods, and under Diocletian, the order was given to burn every Christian book, level every Christian church throughout Rome. Christians in every town were seized, severely tortured, and then burned alive. This was often carried out by the local pagans. Officers of the state were not required to carry out these executions, and no sympathy was granted for age or gender. So men, women, and children, even infants, were killed because of their beliefs or the beliefs of their parents. So for about 250 years, Christians living within the Roman Empire had a hard life that we could not imagine. Then, in the year 313, under Emperor Constantine, the persecution stopped. Now, if you're taking notes, you better write down this guy's name because he is important. Christianity was legal again. Overnight. And for the longest period of time since Christ, Christians were free from persecution. They came out from hiding and were allowed to worship their God. And after all those years, that had to feel pretty good. Any questions? Yes, ma'am. Was there a basic reason why the Roman Empire despised the Christians so much and persecuted them? So my answer would have to be conjecture. Okay, the only thing I could... So here's my best guess, because each Roman emperor, and this is something we got to remember, just to lay a little bit of a foundation. There was horrible persecution for the Christians, and then there might have been one or two Roman emperors that didn't really care. So in certain regions of the Roman Empire, you could pretty much be persecution-free, and in other areas, they were really coming down on you. And then another emperor would come up and really lay down the heavy hand. So it went back and forth, and we can read the writings of these guys, but here's what it comes down to, and this is a concept that we all need to understand. For most of Earth's history, government and religion were one. Whoever was in charge in that government, they wanted everybody to worship their God. And for most of the world, it didn't matter because they were polytheistic anyhow. So they're like, okay, whatever, add one more. And it wasn't a big deal. We'll get one of their idols and keep it in the home. So, you know, we're good with whoever's in charge, and it's not a big deal. It is a big deal for Christians and Jews. It should be a big deal for Christians and Jews. I'm going to say this, and you're going to think I'm crazy, but you should die before you are idolatrous. Idolatry was a capital crime. There was a period in history where if you were caught worshiping other gods, you were killed, often by your closest people in your life, your family and friends, because they were the ones that found out. That is the level of seriousness that God puts on idolatry. So the Christians and the Jews would not play ball. Every other people group within the Roman Empire, whoever they took over, most of them were like, yeah, whatever. Your God, my God, the next God. We're good with that. But there is one God, Hashem, who says, I am the only God. All of the rest are fake. They are false gods. They don't exist. You're talking to wood and stone. I am the creator, and he's a jealous God. So that is why we should take idolatry seriously. And the Christians in those days, they did. Christians and Jews took it very seriously. Great question. I lost my place. I'm getting there. Let's see. Okay. I said any questions, and we got one. That was perfect. Anyone else? Okay, we're going to keep moving. We need to focus on Constantine for a minute to see what life was like for the Christian during this time. So Rome had not been a stable and peaceful government throughout its existence. From the founding of the Roman Empire around 500 BC, the Roman armies kept the lands that they conquered. And then they made the people in those lands the new Roman citizens. And then they imposed taxes on those people. And they gave those people new rules that they had to live under. Although this generated a great amount of revenue for the Roman government, it also caused a lot of problems. The people that they took over, they did not want to be Roman citizens. And they did not want to pay the Roman government their tax money. Rome used their money they collected to build larger and larger armies to conquer more and more lands. And Rome's ever-increasing border made the people in the next country over nervous that they were going to be the next ones taken over by Rome. The conquered people were resentful towards their new government because of the new taxes and the new laws imposed on them. So it was difficult to keep this massive empire all happy. Along with contention from without, there was a great deal of fighting from within. Now, I don't know how many of you would qualify as an amateur Roman historian, but let me tell you, it was madness. You have never seen a soap opera as good as Roman families battling it out amongst one another. It was madness. Most Roman emperors came to power through bloodshed, killing friends and family to gain their position. So being a Roman emperor who was popular with the people, the army, and the politicians made your life much, much easier. As the Christians came out from hiding, Emperor Constantine claimed he was a Christian. Emperor Constantine was not a Christian. He was not even close to a Christian. Emperor Constantine remained a sun-worshipping pagan till the day he died. However, when he rose to power, the population of the Roman Empire that was Christian, and this is agreed upon in every source I could find, was that Rome was no less than 10% Christian when he came to power. The entire Roman Empire, all the way to England, northern part of Africa, all the way around the Mediterranean, 10%. There are sources that will state that they believe the Roman Empire was as much as 50% Christian by the time Constantine came to power. Now, keep in mind, it wasn't a really easy number to figure out, because for a long time, if they knew you were a Christian, they killed you. So it wasn't information you were ready to give up for just any pollster that bothered you on your phone. Emperor Constantine assumed the head of the church and started to manage Christianity. Now, please allow me to make my case. It is very important you understand that Emperor Constantine was born under a pagan god. He grew up in pagan lands and supported pagan gods till the day of his death. Emperor Constantine saying he was a Christian was a political move and nothing more. If Emperor Constantine was a Christian, then I'm an astronaut. He was not a Christian. We will start with a timeline. 220 AD. Emperor Elagabalus. Now, if you're going to do your own homework, that was not his name when he was born. That was the name given to him after he died, the name that he wanted to take on. He was born Marcus Aurelius Antoninus. He served as the head priest of the sun god in Roman-occupied Syria, where he was raised. He introduced the sun god to the Roman Empire. Sol Invictus. If you're taking notes, Sol, S-O-L, Invictus, I-N-V-I-C-T-U-S. And in Greek, it was Apollo, the sun god. In 274 AD, Emperor Aurelian made Sol Invictus the official god of the Roman Empire. Sol Invictus means the unconquered sun, or the undefeated sun, talking about the sun god. We believe Constantine was born around 272, 273, right around the same time that the Roman Empire made Sol Invictus their official god of the empire. Constantine was raised in a nation where the sun god and all its idols were everywhere. In 306 AD, the father of Constantine dies, and in 308 AD, Constantine is, I don't want to say crowned, he's named Caesar of the West. There is still contention in the empire, and several other men are fighting to become emperor. So why was Constantine the emperor of the West and not the emperor of Rome? Well, 15 years prior, Emperor Diocletian believed the Roman Empire was too large to be effectively governed by one man. So he divided the Roman Empire into four regions. He split up the empire and appointed co-emperors, or junior emperors. They were to manage the three other sections. The father of Constantine, Constantius Chlorus, was one of those co-emperors. When his dad died, Constantine was named emperor, but only over one quarter of the Roman Empire. When Emperor Diocletian died, civil war broke out, and each of the four co-emperors is now fighting to be the big kahuna and to be the emperor over all of Rome again. Right? Why would you only want to be king over a quarter of the known world? We want to be king over the whole thing. In 312 AD, Emperor Constantine defeats Maxentius at the Milvian Bridge. Now, this is one of the most important events in the life of Constantine. This is when he vanquishes one of his enemies, one of the other emperors, and he really consolidates a lot of power. Along with that, the evening before the battle, Constantine claims that he had a vision from God, and that is when he became a Christian. The following year, in 313 AD, Emperor Constantine issues the Edict of Milan, granting religious freedom to worship. Constantine named himself head of the church, and his political appointment of himself as the head of all Christianity on earth was the last thing in his life that even resembled a Christian act. I will now make my argument for why I believe Constantine, quote, became a Christian for political reasons, and his life had nothing to do with Jesus or the Bible until the day he died. The Arch of Constantine was made a couple years after Emperor Constantine had his vision and became a Christian, and his decisive victory made him the emperor. Is the arch covered in symbols and pictures of Christ and the apostles? Constantine is not just a Christian. He brought Christianity to the Roman Empire. He made it legal again. He named himself the head of the church. Surely, in this arch, we can see the glory of God and evidence of the scriptures in his life. Nope. We see images of a sacrifice to Hercules and a sacrifice to Apollo, his sun god. Apollo, the sun god, is on the top of the east side of the arch, so it is the first to be illuminated by the rising sun each day. The roundel shows Apollo driving a four-horse chariot known as a quadriga. On the original arch, it was topped off with a bronze portrait of himself, Constantine riding in a four-horse chariot, just like Apollo and his quadriga. It is very important you understand that Constantine was not a Christian. Constantine was not a lukewarm Christian. He was not an apathetic, mediocre Christian. He was a sun-worshipping pagan till the day he died. Constantine and his successor, Theodosius, destroyed biblical Christianity. Any questions? Did he declare himself to be a god? So let's go with yes and no. All the way back in the days of Julius Caesar, they started the imperial cult where they worshiped the emperors, and Augustus claimed that he was a god, and the idea that every Roman emperor that succeeded him would be a god. So was he worshiped as a god? Yes. Did he like being worshiped as a god? You tell me in the next 5 minutes. In 321 AD, Constantine introduced the first civil legislation concerning Sunday. Let all the judges and town people and the occupation of all trades rest on the venerable day of the sun. Constantine wanted everyone to observe the day of his God, the day of the sun. Sunday. That's where the name comes from. If you were ever wondering why the day of rest changed from Saturday to Sunday, it wasn't because Jesus did it. It was made into law by a Roman emperor. In 325, Emperor Constantine calls the Council of Nicaea. The Catholic Church calls this the first ecumenical council. The first of 21 ecumenical councils. If I haven't made this clear yet, Emperor Constantine and his successor Theodosius are the founders of a pagan, state-run form of pseudo-Christianity called Roman Catholicism. The Catholic Church considers the Council of Nicaea the first of 21 ecumenical councils. It was convened by and run by the head of the Church of Rome, the Roman Emperor Constantine. At the Council of Nicaea, Constantine made several anti-Semitic statements and made a plan for separating the date for Easter, a pagan holiday, from Passover and the Feast of First Fruits, the actual days when Messiah was crucified and resurrected. In 330 AD, Emperor Constantine moves the capital of the Roman Empire over 900 miles east to present-day Istanbul. It's a 1,400-mile drive across land. Constantine didn't name the new capital after Jesus or some noble principle from the scriptures. He, in an act of great Christian humility, named the city of Byzantium after himself, Constantinople. And he built a 40-foot-tall statue of himself there. Now, Constantinople already had a statue. In the center of the new city of Constantinople was the Forum of Constantine, a gigantic oval courtyard containing a column 100 feet tall with a bronze statue of the sun god Apollo. Emperor Constantine modified the statue. He removed the face of the statue of Apollo and replaced it with his own face. Emperor Constantine was depicted as the sun god Apollo. Remember, this is the head of Christianity. In 337 AD, Emperor Constantine dies. Roman coins were minted with Sol Invictus, the unconquered sun god, up to and beyond the death of Constantine. Throughout Constantine's entire reign as emperor, he had coins minted in Rome with his face on one side and the sun god Apollo on the other. Again, standard 101 Christianity, right? Does anyone see the life of Constantine representing Christianity in any way? No. He was born and raised a sun-worshipping pagan. He remained a sun-worshipping pagan till the day of his death. And the state-run Church of Rome that was headed by the sun-worshipping Roman emperor had nothing to do with Jesus or the Bible. I believe it was the first pseudo-Christian church, a fake version of Christianity that Peter warns us about in the New Testament. Peter says, "But there were false prophets also among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you, who privily shall bring in damnable heresies, even denying the Lord that bought them, and bring upon themselves swift destruction." In the weeks ahead, when we get into Matthew chapter 24, we will talk a lot about pseudo-Christian churches. They play a key role in the end times. What we need to recognize is that the devil has been trying to start false churches with false prophets and false teachers for over 2,000 years. That's what Peter's saying. It was going on in his day. He said it's going to continue on in the future. And the devil started a couple of real successful ones. Then, the single worst event in the history of the church happened. Emperor Theodosius, write that one down, guys. Emperor Theodosius made Christianity mandatory throughout the Roman Empire. It became the state religion of Rome. The church was filled with unregenerate pagans because joining Christianity was not optional. Every pagan idol worshiper in the Roman Empire was forced to convert to Christianity under penalty of death. Those who did not convert were considered heretics. And in that First Council of Nicaea that so many Christians are so happy about, he talks about how God has given him the power to hunt out and kill all the heretics. Anyone who did not believe in Nicene Christianity. At the same time, all forms of paganism were forbidden and pagan temples were destroyed. Pagan festivals and holidays were outlawed as well. Now let me ask you this. Did every pagan lay down their idols and say, okay, I'll just be a Christian now. Good enough. No. Paganism was Christianized. The state-sponsored version of Christianity that was run by the Roman emperor merged together with all the paganism found in the empire. If you look up the edict of Theodosius in 380 AD, you will see that Theodosius calls his version of Christianity Catholic Christianity. He says it. Catholic meaning ecumenical. What is that? Bring everyone together. Everyone comes together and we all get along. All under one big tent. Universal. Yep. To make the transition easier, pagan festivals were converted into Christian ones. The Roman state-run Christian church tried to combine paganism and Christianity to help make it a smooth transition. This calendar on the screen is called the Wheel of the Year. It outlines the festivals of witches and other pagans. The wheel is divided up into eight sections for their eight Sabbaths. They are based on the solar calendar. There are two at the spring and fall equinox. That's when the daytime and the nighttime are equal in length. And there are two at the winter and the summer solstice, one for the longest night of the year and the shortest day, and one for the longest day of the year and the shortest night. Four more are at the midpoint between the solstice and the equinox. Yule, which is the Chaldean word for infant, is celebrated during the winter solstice on December 21st, now Christmas. We will talk about that a lot next Friday. The spring equinox is on March 20th this year, and it is the celebration of the Babylonian goddess Ishtar, now Easter. Oh, she's the fertility goddess. Her symbols are bunnies and eggs. We will talk a lot about that one in the spring. Remember, pagan festivals and holidays were outlawed. Again, I ask you, did all the pagans just give up and become Christians? No! To make the transition easier, the state-run Church of Rome, which was pagan for centuries, took pagan holidays and Sabbaths and called them Christian so that everyone in the Roman Empire could all get along. By the way, getting along is not a Christian principle. Getting along requires tolerance. Tolerance of sin. Tolerance of idolatry. The opposite of tolerance is repentance. We see sin, we see idolatry, we see things that are displeasing to God, we turn from them and we go in the other direction. That's repentance. That is the opposite of tolerance. When we tolerate, it dominates. When we tolerate sin in our family, that sin will dominate our family. As Christians, we don't tolerate sin in our life. As fathers, we don't tolerate sin in the lives of our children. As husbands, we don't tolerate sin in our families. And I, as a pastor, am commanded by God to never tolerate sin in the church. It is weak leadership that tolerates. It is a weak father that tolerates disobedient children, and a weak husband that tolerates a sinful and godless family. Strong leadership is willing to have an uncomfortable confrontation with sin and fix it. Weak leadership is passive, and it tolerates sin. There are plenty of churches you can go to where they're going to tolerate everything. This is not one of them. I'm having a t-shirt made. Church of Grace, I'm not for everyone. Folks, I am a 1 and 5 star pastor. That's it. I get 2 ratings on Google, 5 stars and 1. Nothing in between. The question was, do I know why Theodosius chose Christianity and not Judaism? Short answer is no, I don't. The conjecture is, by that time, 50% of the Roman Empire was Christian, and it was a political move to try to get everyone along. But keep in mind, it's not like he chose Christianity that opposed paganism. He made a state-run version of Christianity that accepted and brought in all paganism. The goal was to get everyone under one banner. The temple of Antonius and Faustina became the church of San Lorenzo. Pagan temples became churches. It's funny, though, all the pagan temples that were converted into churches were all converted into Catholic churches. Actual Christian churches were not built until 1000 AD. They were bulldozed, and the people that went to them were burned at the stake by the state-run version of Christianity. You see, the real Christians were worshiping God underground, and they were in hiding. Pagan priests slipped into position in these Christian churches, and with them came all of their idolatrous pagan customs. And what the persecution of the church could not accomplish in 250 years, the marrying of the church to paganism accomplished like that. Instantly, it was destroyed. The true Christians went underground. They wanted nothing to do with it, and they worshiped the true God in secret. The real Christians were hunted and killed for another 1,000 years. This started because they would not join the Roman pagan version of Christianity. From this single event, Christianity worldwide has been suffering because of this union with paganism. Today, we are still fighting this marriage to paganism in American Christian churches. With that being said, we're not going to go over all of the different feast days and Sabbaths of the witches and pagans. I just wanted to mention a couple. I don't know if you guys noticed the other one, but since we're here, you should probably notice that there is another one. So if you look at this one, which looks like it's pronounced Samhain, it's Samhain. Okay, that happens on November 1st. What holiday do you think that coincides with? Yeah, Halloween. You ready for this, Christians? If you're still celebrating Halloween and you think that, like, that one's a good and godly holiday, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. Like, there, you know, that one, that's a softball. That one, the devil's like, here you go, Christians. You guys can figure this one out. Where were the real Christians during this whole time? Yeah, there was a group that was underground that the Catholics were hunting down and burning at the stake all over the world. Okay, those were the real Christians. in Theodosius's 380 edict, he talks about how anyone that is not following his version that he called Catholic Christianity were heretics and were allowed to be hunted down and killed. Folks, I challenge you to not believe one word I'm saying. Don't believe any of it. Go home and do your own homework and see if you can find a source that says anything otherwise. Now, let's look at a story in the Bible as we are running out of time. Because keep in mind, remember, that what we're trying to do is paint the picture of the problem of Christianity and paganism being married together. Our story starts with the staff of Asclepius. In Numbers chapter 21, verses 4 through 9, the Israelites were wandering in the wilderness with Moses for 40 years. And the Israelites complained to Moses, just about everything. And God sends fiery serpents through the camp. And the way the Bible reads, these fiery serpents seem to have bitten everybody, and people start getting sick and dropping dead. The people cried to Moses. Moses asked God what to do, and then God told Moses how to fix this mess. Moses made a serpent out of brass and put it on a pole, and God said, "Whoever looks upon the serpent will live." The people looked upon the serpent, and they were saved. Now, that is a strange story, and that story is never explained in the Old Testament anywhere. It is explained in the two verses preceding John 3:16, the most popular verse in the Bible. Jesus says, "Just like the serpent was lifted up, so shall the Son of Man be lifted up." The brazen serpent was a foreshadowing of the crucifixion. To give you the idea, the serpent represents sin. Bronze or brass is a metal that withstands fire. Fire is the judgment of God. Jesus took on and became sin for us, so the wrath of God could come upon him. He died, but was resurrected and was able to bring life to everybody. It gives a great picture of how one gets saved. Back in Numbers 21, all the Jews had to do was look at the serpent and believe it would save them. That's it. In the same way, that is exactly what it takes to save your soul. Look to Jesus and believe. Now, here's how this story relates to our message tonight. In 2 Kings 18, we read about King Hezekiah. He was one of only a couple of good kings in the nation of Judah. He did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, and King Hezekiah turned the nation of Israel from worshiping idols and paganism back to a people who worshiped the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We read about something interesting in 2 Kings 18 in verse 4. We read, "He removed the high places and break the images and cut down the groves and break in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made, for unto those days the children of Israel did burn incense to it." The people kept the bronze serpent for over 800 years. And they ended up worshiping it as an idol. And Hezekiah finally put an end to it. An object that God commanded to be made can later become a pagan idol that needs to be destroyed. How then does anyone think they can take a pagan festival, a pagan idol, or a pagan practice and somehow clean them up and make them acceptable to God? That is not the way God does it throughout the entire Bible. In the book of Acts, when a whole bunch of new believers came to Christ And Paul found out that they were involved in witchcraft and had all of these books about witchcraft. What did they do? They piled them up and they burned them. In 2 Kings, when King Josiah purges the land of idols, he destroys them. There is no mixing holy and pagan. In 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14, we read, "Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? What communion hath light with darkness?" God makes two comparisons. You have righteousness and unrighteousness, and you have light and you have darkness. Do you understand there is no middle ground? There's no place where they get together. Darkness is the complete absence of light. And there is no righteousness in sin. God cannot bless sin. It is impossible. There is no amount of Christianity we can mix into paganism to make it acceptable to God. Now, I want to briefly outline this idea of mixing of paganism and holiness, and then we're going to go home. We're almost done. On the screen here, all the way to the left, we find things that are acceptable to God. These things are found in the Bible. God commands it. He outlines it. He tells us the process and the procedure, and God gives us parameters and stipulations. Do you know that we cannot just do it however we want? One of the biggest problems of American Christianity today is all of these Christians seem to think that we can have Burger King Christianity. Have it your way. Nope. It's not what God sounds like when I read the Bible. God is not Burger King Christianity. He says, do it my way. We need to do it exactly how God wants it done. Do you know why people get mad at Patrick? One reason. I do it this way. They don't like it. That's it. Patrick's mean. Shut up. You are lucky you're not in the Old Testament dealing with one of those prophets. Patrick's narrow-minded. Yep. About that narrow. Outside of this book, everyone likes me. That's a lie. Outside of this book, some people like me. When it gets to this book, that's why people don't like Patrick. All the way to the right of this picture, we find things that are unacceptable to God. Paganism, idolatry, disobedience, worldliness, and in general, anything created by Satan. Now, what do you think we find in the center column? The center column is the merging of the two. And the question you need to ask yourself is this: who finds that center column acceptable? It ain't God. Satan finds that acceptable. Lukewarm, mediocre, pathetic Christians who don't have standards find that acceptable. The world. What's the big deal? Oh, my soul. If I had a dollar for every time I heard that, it makes me sick. Satan tried to destroy Christianity for 3 centuries after Christ with persecution that we could not imagine. It didn't matter how many people were killed, Christianity grew. In 300 AD, Satan changed tactics. He went back plan that he instituted almost 3,500 years ago, and it worked just as well. If you can't kill them, have them reject God and adopt paganism. So, if you can't figure out where we're going yet, let me pull the Band-Aid off. Christmas and Easter are completely pagan festivals where the Roman emperors tried to mix in Christianity to appease the masses. There it is. Next week, I am going to destroy Christmas for you. It is going to be Patrick Hayes versus Santa Claus in the Thunderdome. I am going to choke him out until the life drains from his eyes, and then I am going to kill and eat Rudolph. Look, it's going to be a lot of fun. Okay, remember, folks, listen up. I want to give you an idea here. Just hear me out. Take a deep breath and listen to me for a second. I never promised you that you would like what you hear at this church. I've never made that promise to anyone. Ever. I promise you that I will give you the truth. The truth has no agenda. It doesn't care how you feel. The truth will set you free. That's what Jesus said. The Church of Grace is going to continue to shock and awe as we teach the Bible the way it is written. I think it's obvious. I am not trying to make everyone happy. This here tonight, not how you make everybody happy. I know that. I don't like teaching these messages. I get all torn up inside, intense, and I want to throw up because I know people are going to hate what I say up here. I went soft on a message one time, and I still regret it. I'm ashamed of myself. I can't live doing that. We are not trying to be like every other church. To stay at the Church of Grace, you need to take the red pill. Some of you are thinking, Patrick, my doctor's got me on a bunch of pills, but none of them are red. So let me explain to you, baby birds, I'll feed you. There's a movie. Called The Matrix. There's a fella in the movie, Keanu Reeves. He's the lead of the movie. And in this movie, all of humanity on planet Earth is asleep. And they're controlled by robots. And the robots just use the humans as batteries to power themselves. Okay, that's what they do in the movie. And there's this one small group of people who escaped, woke up, got out of the machine. And while you're in the machine, the robots are just feeding you ideas and a movie, and you're just playing out in your mind like a dream, life. And you think you're alive, but you're not. You're in this like cryo state of sleep where the robots are using you for your energy. Hopefully you've seen the movie. If not, you live in a cave. It was like the greatest movie, you know, in the 90s, I think. It was up there as far as sci-fi goes. So anyway, this group comes to Neo, Keanu Reeves' character, and this one fella, Morpheus, offers Keanu Reeves two choices. Red pill, blue pill. You take the blue pill, you go back to sleep, you wake up tomorrow, you won't remember anything that happened, and you will just be part of the machine, you will be dreaming your dream, you will have a happy life, and then one day you will die and nothing will happen. Or you take the red pill and you find out what the truth is. And we're going to wake you up. We're going to get you out of the matrix. You're going to escape from the robots. And you're going to join our little band on the ship, the Nebuchadnezzar. And we are going, yeah, that was what it was called. There's some symbolism there. I get it. And we are going to fight the robots and defeat the, I don't remember what the bad guys were called. Okay. Pill, take a blue pill. Do you want to know something? The majority of Christians in America, they want the blue pill. They want to go to church on Sunday for an hour. They want to punch the clock. They want to feel like a Christian. They can go throughout their life and they can think they're a good Christian and they don't have to read their Bible. They don't have to do anything God says and they can just live their life and they can feel like a good Christian. And I'm not saying this church is perfect, and I'm not saying this church is the best church out there. I'm not saying any of those things, but this is not a blue pill church. This is a church where if you want to know the truth and you want to hear the teaching of the Bible the way that it was written, you want to know the history, that's what you're going to get here. Do you know how hard it's going to be for a church like this to reach 250 people? Or 500 or 1,000 people? Where every year I teach a message where I murder Santa Claus and I beat up Norman Rockwell paintings and I kill nostalgia? It's not easy. This church is not for everyone. I get it. Everyone's welcome here, but everyone ain't staying. But you're going to get the truth here whether you like it or not. So I ask that you would take the red pill. You got a question? So you're against the Christmas message? Okay, then I got a verse for you. Proverbs 18:13. He that answereth the matter before he heareth it, it is a folly and a shame unto him. It's contempt prior to investigation. That's where most of the world is going to live. And if you're against what I'm going to teach before I teach it, then I can't help you. Okay, good night, everybody. Let's have a word of prayer, and we'll get out of here. And next week, we're going to go over pagan Christmas.